accession number 19057, Real One.
Mr. O'Neill, Real One. Slipper, can you tell me where and when you were born, please?
Battersea, 1926, 29th January, so I assume.
What did your father do for a living?
A plasterer. My grandfather was a plasterer. Great-grandfather was a plasterer, and so was I.
And what was Battersea like in the 1920s?
Interesting, I suppose. It was run down, but it was very working class area. And I come from a family of plasterers that go back several generations.
What was your education like?
Rather exceptionally good, because originally I went to what they called the Battersea Central School. But at the outbreak of war, we was evacuated to Rowland's Castle outside Portsmouth. And there was only seven of us in the class from, I suppose, I was just turned 14 then until I left school at 16 and a half. We had rather good education. In fact, I was able to take my trick at 16. The first attempt I took, I got a distinction for history and failed everything else, which particularly annoyed the headmaster as he refused to let me do history anymore until I retook the trek.
Did you have any hobbies or sports when you were a lad?
We had a cadet force in Rowland's Castle, played football, running, jumping, cycling. I ended up as head prefect. I left about 16 and a half to come back to London then. That was 1942.
Mm. Coming back, do you remember the declaration of war?
Oh, yeah. I was... we'd arrived in Rowland's Castle on the 1st of September, and we were sitting in the first appearance I was put in on the Sunday morning, 11 o'clock, listening to the broadcast, yeah, quite well.
What was your reaction to that?
No particular reaction, it was happening. That was September 3rd. We saw the winter through, and it was particularly struck me. I was 4 miles away from the village, and I had to get to the school 4 miles, which, after coming and living in London and walking through snowdrifts, wasn't particularly amusing, going to a school in the first winter of the war. Which was a particularly heavy one.
And you were evacuated with the school?
Yeah.
How did that work?
Worked very well. We all assembled round the school in Battersea, walked round to the station at Battersea Park Road and caught the train and straight down to Rowland's Castle. And then they spent the rest of the day finding billets for everybody. But, it was a very amusing and happy time because, we was completely free. First couple of months, there was no school whatsoever because we was too far away from any school. And then they got us organised and... it was rather a good education because there were so few of us in the class.
How did you get on with the locals?
Didn't see a lot of them. We didn't see a lot of local children. We were separate as a school and remained as a school.
And did you see any evidence of the war at that time down there?
1940, yes, because we was just outside Portsmouth. And you used to get a lot of bombing raids and one or two planes brought down. And by 1940, we'd acquired bikes, so we used to cycle into Portsmouth during the weekend and cycle down to Ailing Island on the Sundays to, you know, it's all restricted area, but we was only boys then, so we used to wander into army camps, and we actually, when we formed the Cadet Force, we actually trained with the Canadians who landed at Dieppe. You know, we used to wander into their camp, and we had a hell of a time with them.
You said they formed the Cadet Force. Who was in charge of?
One of our school teachers was a captain in the First World War, and he formed a cadet force of about three troops. We'd two rifle, and it was mostly physical training, really. Yes, that went on for about a year, 1941.
Did you collect shrapnel?
No, I wasn't bothered then. I was anxious to get into something.
What service would you have wanted to?
I wasn't particularly, the only service open to us was infantry, but when I left school 42, I come up to London straight away, joined the Home Guard when I was early 17. We had a headquarters at Clapham Junction, and immediately they asked for volunteers for the rocket launchers in Battersea Park. And I thought it was a good idea. We was going to get paid £3 a night that was well worth it. Well worth it, two nights a week. And then I think there was rather bad winter. We was always getting called out onto the park overnight, and I thought it was a good idea to get in the plotting room. And I was rather good at maths, so I think they took me with open arms to, working out calculations for the radar in the plotting room.
So the rocket launchers in Battersea Park were organised and run by the Home Guard?
No, they was all run and organised by the regular army, the ACAC thing, but they was manned at night time by Home Guard volunteers. There was 120 launchers, each had two rockets. The amazing thing was, because at that time the only people in the Home Guard were young lads, 17, or old men over 55, and these rockets weighed 80 pounds each, would have to be lifted up 4 feet onto a cradle. And we always had complaints whenever we fired these rocket launchers around Clapham Junction by of unexploded shells going through people's roofs. But, the people on the park, manning the guns, they was only part-timers, and you had to set the fuses with a special tool, and half the fuses never got set. And then half the rockets were not put into the cradle properly, and there'd be a misfire, and all panic was let loose. But I think in 12 months I was on the rockets in Battersea Park, we actually brought down one aircraft. Well, we claimed we brought one down. But apparently they was calibrated so that a whole battery of 240 rockets could fire into a box and bring down any aircraft within like a half a mile box, but we only ever brought one down. but by 1942 it was the Baedeker raids, the single aircraft raids. I don't think they had the rocket launchers early on when they had the mass raids. Well, it was very good. We used to pack up in the summer months. We'd come off duty at 5 o'clock in the morning, stood down. We used to get the boats out on Battersea Park Lake.
Did you get any training to use the rocket launchers?
Oh, yes. They had a training place at Walton-on-the-Nave, which we went down there a couple of times. There wasn't much training to do. Just load them up, set the fuses, stand behind a shield and pull the lever. The bloke who was firing, all he had to do was press, had earphones on and press it at the commander from the command post. The chap who had the work to do was the loader, who had to go and get the rockets and load them onto the cradles, which was heavy work.
Who did that? Was that mainly the young members of the...
Yeah, yes, it was usually the young members, and I was glad to get off that and get into the plotting room.
Did you do any other training with the Home Guard?
Yes, we did. I had 3 months with a rifle at Clapham Junction, and we used to do fire watching at Emmanuel School and the Royal Victoria Building on Clapham Common, which was at that time an interrogation centre for German captured German POWs. We used to guard it. You put that in brackets, we couldn't guard anything.
Did you have any contact with the POWs?
No, none whatsoever. We was just there for fire watching. We did have a couple of raids with fire bombs come through, you know, those little small fire bombs come through the roof, which we had to, you get a bucket and spade to, and a bucket of sand to put over them and get rid of them.
So what was the area like around Battersea? Had it suffered much in the Blitzes?
Yes, it had. There was quite a bit of bombing. My own house down at Battersea, as a landmine had dropped just at the back of the house, so all the windows were boarded up, and we was more or less, although we had a three-story house, we was more or less all living in a basement at the time. All the windows were blown out upstairs. But I was only home for about 12 months, and when the second winter started to come on, I think it was 1943, I volunteered to join the army then.
Before we do that, you moved into the plotting room with the Home Guard. Mm. What did that job consist of?
Well, you get the radar reports come in, and they plot the thing on the plotting table, and then you get you work out calculations of the range and height from tables that were given you, and somebody would shout a number at you, you'd look it up on a table and it's all logarithms, and then you shout back a number that they'd set on the plotting table, and then when the plane got in range, they'd give the order to fire through the phones in the park, which was a very interesting occupation, as well as getting paid for it then. 3 bob a night was quite useful.
How many German aircraft would usually come over, and what kind of regularity would they come over?
Oh, about one or two in the morning we'd usually have to turn out, but in the plotting room we usually had to turn out more than the park did, because any aircraft about London, we had to be there plotting them, so we spent more time on service than the people in the park. They only were called out when a plane was coming near, or a group of planes were coming near, but we were plotting the whole of London. And we also, yes, during the training for it, they took us down to the main command depot at the old Brompton Road tube station. Right down in the basement, there was the command depot. And they took us there and showed us the plotting room there. And their orders went to us at the individual parks. I think there was another one at Shooter's Hill in Woolwich, another rocket thing, but there was AK-AK guns all the way around London at the time. And they even had them on the railway as well.
So how did you come to join the army?
It was getting winter, and I thought, well, I didn't want to spend another winter turning out every night, and I thought it was a change to join the army. I was actually working at the time as a clerk in London, in the city. I was a clerk in the city. I joined a firm of flour importers that was importing flour from Canada. But it was quite an interesting job. When I joined the firm, there was four people in the office. Within 4 months, they had all left, and I was doing the work of four people myself, and I was finished by 12 o'clock, and I used to wander around the city for 2 hours every midday. And very, very, very good exploring the city every day for about 2 hours and have my lunch. But
where was your office?
In the Minories in the city. But, you know, it was a dead-end job, but it was all right for a time. And after when winter started coming on in 1943, I thought I'd join the army. So I volunteered, and I think it was beginning of 44. I think I joined, or at the end of 43.
How did you go about enlisting?
Can't remember. I think I went round to an office in the city. There's a recruitment place there, and I wandered in and asked them one day while I was wandering around exploring the city, and discussed it, and oh yeah, you can join up, all right. and I got called up to Bradford for initial training. There was 40 people on this initial draft. I think it was a month initial training, you know, rifle and bayonet stuff and marching up and down. And you have various aptitude tests. And one of the aptitude tests was they have a door lock in pieces and you have to put it together. And out of 40, I was the only one who put a door lock to pieces. I'd never seen one before. You know, assembled it. And, of course, that meant I have mechanical aptitude. So out of the 40, I was the only person sent to the Armoured Corps. But I wasn't supposed to go to the Armoured Corps because when I left Battersea Park, they gave me a letter to do regular army training on the rocket launchers, because I'd been on them for 12 months. But I think that letter got lost somehow, because I ended up in Bovington tank training place, which I was then put on a 26 weeks course as a wireless driver operator, they call it. You have 18 weeks for learning radio, gunnery, driving, everything to do with a tank.
How had you taken to the basic training before you were sent to Bovington?
Oh, I was young and very fit and very keen then. yes, I was recommended to go to Wasby. You know, they had they called it a Wasby, an officer's training place in Northern Ireland, but then they said I'd be out of the war for 7 or 8 months, so I decided to go to Bovington instead.
So you had any problems with drill?
No. No, I could. I was quite coordinated, actually, when I was young. Oh, we got down to Bombington, and the radio training was a bit difficult. I never got beyond 12 words a minute on Morse code, but that was sufficient to enable you to be a wireless operator. And in fact, I never ever used Morse code at all the whole time I was served in a tank.
What was the limit that was needed?
12 words a minute was the pass rate. 18 words a minute if you was on aircraft, but I just managed to scrape through 12 words a minute, so I was all right to go on a gunnery course and the tank handling course and the driving course. But we only trained on Sherman tanks. We never see anything else, and they was 75 millimetre Shermans.
When did you arrive at Bovington?
January 44. Yeah, January 44. And we finished training by about... It was 6 months training. I finished in July 44. There was a rush then because they expected a lot of casualties at D-Day. And so there was a rush to get... push a lot of youngsters through their training, so there'll be reinforcements. But actual D-Day, I was in Lulworth Cove doing when all the planes and ships went across at D-Day, and we was doing a wireless course so we could monitor the actual action on the Normandy beaches at the time in Bovington.
With the training, did they specify what you would become in the tank crew at an early stage?
Yeah. Depends on your aptitude. I think it also depended on your education, too. If you I had a matric, that meant you was you'd go for a wireless operator. If you was not so well-educated, you was a gunner, and of course those with driving experience went in for as a driver. They did segregate people out.
But you had to do all the types of training as well?
Oh, yes.
Any role within the tank?
Yeah.
What was the gunnery training like?
7 weeks course at Lulworth Cove. We fired every type of gun, rifle, revolver, Piat, machine guns, ordinary machine guns, Brens, tank machine guns, and then the tank guns like the 75mm. And they wanted... if you was a loader, see how fast it was and whether you can set the fuses and get load up quickly. And I was usually very quick on doing things like that.
And you had a driving course as well?
Yes, had a driving course. Learned to drive everything from Jeep, 1500 weight, 3-tonner, and then they took you on to driving tanks. And my initial drive in a tank was I always remember going down into Swanage. You change up five gears, and then the chap in the turret said stop, so I pulled the two sticks back, and the tank shot off the road and through a brick wall of a house. Of course, you're supposed to change down, but they didn't tell me that.
So what happened next?
That's it. Tank on training. Couldn't help. It wasn't actually through the house. It was the garden wall and shed that I'd gone through, but... that's it, tank training. Bad luck, old chap. Oh, and on exercise, we had a quite a bit of round the hills of Swanage, and there we had one or two German aircraft come over and got hit and bailed out, and we were chasing round on one of our wireless exercise and captured these two German airmen who had bailed out. And always all very efficient and very keen we were then. But that was our training from Bovington to run down into Swanage. That was our driving instruction.
How many crew are there in a Sherman tank?
Well, the 75mm is driver, co-driver, gunner, operator and tank commander, five in the 75. But the 17-pounder is one less because there's a bigger gun and there's no driver or bow gunner. That's all loaded with shells.
And you were training on this 75?
75, yeah. But